there's one thing that David Cronenberg wants his audience to leave with from A History of Violence, is that there's no place in America more dangerous to get a cup of coffee than a lunch counter. And why would you anyway, when there's Sparkplug coffee? Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer a variety of blends and roasts, including decaf and half-calf, and even offer a rotating selection for adventurous types who want to discover their newest favorite kind of coffee. But what makes Sparkplug special is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or take advantage of their set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never have to worry about running out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The offer applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to stay out of local diners and start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Coffee!
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action!
Hi there, movie monkeys and monkettes, and thank you for downloading the 135th edition of the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that harkens back many years to analyze various films. If you have a hankering to hear us jam about the 123 American Film Institute motion pictures, all of them are in our back catalog online. Warning right now that we will be spoiling every bit of this flick. I'm the gentle restaurateur from small town Indiana, Ryan Ellis. And here's my gangster wife, who's good at killing people, Bev.
That's me.
Ed Harris in this movie. Quite a menacing fellow. So the coming attractions trivia. This week's picture, the second one in the month of Bev, History of Violence. Prior to this movie in 2005, only one of David Cronenberg's movies had ever been nominated for an Oscar. That's 14 previous movies and 30 years of directing. Just one Oscar nomination and a win, as it turned out, in that movie. What was that film?
So I never got around to looking this up, so I'm going to take a guess, and I think it's wrong even as I say it out loud, but it certainly deserved this nomination. I'm going to say that The Fly got nominated for visual effects or makeup.
You're right. It was the makeup.
Oh.
It won the makeup Oscar, and I think maybe the guy who won that award, Chris Wallace, directed The Fly, too.
I would have guessed that it was Jeremy Irons for Dead Ringers, but I knew that...
Should have been.
Yeah, I knew.
In addition to The Fly makeup, in addition to Goldblum probably being nominated for The Fly in a lead performance. We're going to talk about acting and some of the issues in Cronenberg movies in general, and in this one a little bit later on. But in his best movies, the lead performances, Goldblum, Irons, other actors... Never nominated except for William Hurt in this movie in a supporting performance. And then, actually, the other time would have been Viggo Mortensen for Eastern Promises. So three movies ever with nominations. Two from this film, the script and William Hurt, and all that long career. And like I mentioned last week, John Carpenter, sort of a similar career to Cronenberg, has only ever had and probably only will have one nomination in all of his movies, and that was Jeff Bridges' lead performance in Starman.
Really?
In both cases, how do they not get more recognition for maybe the music scores and certainly the visual effects? Or the makeup.
Well, such is the way of genre filmmaking, right?
Overlooked again and again and again. All right, A History of Violence played at Cannes and TIFF, those two film festivals. Then New Line unfurled it for regular audiences in September 2005. It barely broke even. Although, in Cronenberg's filmography, I think The Fly might be his biggest ever hit. This is up there. But neither of them are what we call big blockbusters. Okay, Bev, tell us what the movie's about with The History of Violence. Skinny.
Viggo Mortensen is Tom Stahl, a mild-mannered small-town diner owner and family man in Indiana. Tom's calm and tidy life is upset when he successfully defends his diner against a pair of violent criminals, becoming a national sensation and getting some unwanted attention from parts of his past that he would have preferred to stay dead and buried.
Or, in a nutshell, food merchant travels to City of Brotherly Love to murder his brother. With love?
Now with love. Bullets.
Just with bullets. I did a count. I could have made this a trivia question, but we recorded last podcast before we saw this movie, so I didn't have the number. Do you know how many people Tom kills in this movie?
Off the top of my head, 4, 5, 6, 7 at least.
10.
10.
Although Richie does finish off Ruben with a gunshot. That whole, how did you fuck that up? But what Tom does to him, Tom slash Joey does to him, probably would have killed him, so I'm counting him. 9 for sure, arguably 10. In this one movie, most of it in self-defense, especially early on. All right, a little number action as always. We'll get through that. Rotten Tomatoes, critics, 87% of them like this movie. 184 fresh, 27 rotten, and 76% of audiences. Pretty good. The movie was 90th at the 2005 U.S. box office. Revenge of the Sith was far and away number one in 05. This film was shot entirely in Toronto and the area, which is typical for Cronenberg. He's almost always shot around here. And sometimes if you know the area or the city itself, you can say, hey, I've been there. I guess New Yorkers and L.A. people have that happen to them all the time. We don't get that so often around here, although more so the last 10 or 20 years, because movies are shot in Toronto a lot more often, but aren't actually set here. This movie is set in Millbrook, Indiana, which I believe is fictional. I looked it up during the movie, and it didn't come up as an actual little town. All right, well, this is your second movie in the month of Bev. So what'd you think of it? Let's get some specific thoughts.
Like all Cronenberg films, History of Violence suffers from a bit of a lack of polish that can make some scenes come across a little movie of the weekish, and that is the last bad thing I will say about this film, which is about as smart, intense, thought-provoking, and powerful as a film can get. Mortensen and Maria Bello are incredible, and William Hurt does more with his, 5-10 minutes of screen time than most actors do in an entire film. And the whole thing is just 94 minutes long, too.
As always with Cronenberg, the movie's not very long, yeah. Hurt doesn't even appear in any way, and it's with a voiceover first until 70 minutes in that phone call, and then you don't see him again for maybe another 5 to 10 minutes. And as you say, he's barely on screen at all, but it is a very memorable performance. It was his most recent Oscar nomination, his fourth ever. He had 3 in a row in the 80s and 1 for Kiss of the Spider Woman. Then he didn't get nominated for about 18 or so years, this supporting nod here. He lost out to George Clooney, not that he necessarily was second, but Clooney won that year for Syriana. And it's interesting because when Clooney won, he went over and shook Hurt's hand. Maybe they knew each other from before, they'd had respect for each other anyway, but partly it's because Hurt is in Syriana with Clooney, oh. I think, is maybe one of the reasons why. But had Hurt won his second Oscar here, it'd be hard to argue with it. It is such an impactful performance for a guy who is barely in the film. I guess you could say his specter is in the whole thing because he's the big mob boss, although it's Ed Harris's Carl Fogarty, who's the big bad through most of it.
You don't even put together that there's another mob boss that Tom even needs to be worried about. Ed Harris's character seems like he's on his own. And then when you later put together that not only was Tom actually Joey, he was actually involved in the mafia, he actually committed a lot of violence, very adeptly as we learn, but his brother's a boss.
There's so much depth in that relationship that we don't get much of, but they say enough. The whole Richie saying, I wanted to kill you when you came home from the hospital. Mom stopped me. Oh, she whacked me good or something like that. But at the same point, he loves his brother, obviously. Part of the problem, I think, with Fogarty, well, that's revenge more so with him. But certainly with Richie is, I just want you back in the fold. Now, then again, he did bring Joey back there to kill him.
Yeah, I disagree with
that.
There seems to be
a sense of regret, though, that he had to actually do it. He obviously was always going to. I guess I'm wrong about that. But just in the sense of, this isn't revenge for me. Fogarty wanted revenge. Okay, Richie needs to kill him. But Richie has more of a sense of regret that Joey ever left. And I think he'd like to have it back, even though he knows he can't.
I disagree. I think Richie is a remorseless sociopath who has about as much love for his brother as he has for any object he feels like he owns.
Why kiss him, then? Why be so remorseful about the whole, oh, you left, you took his eye? Why talk to him at all? I guess you could just say because movies have to have scenes like that rather than just walk up and go bang in the side of the head.
Well, he may want to impress upon him what he did wrong. He could take some personal satisfaction just from the fact that he has the power to get him in the room, that he feels like he won after all these years of wanting a certain level of revenge for screwing up his career. Why would Fogarty toy with him? Why wouldn't he just walk up behind him and pull the trigger and kill him? He's doing it because he enjoys it, because he wants to get some satisfaction of seeing Tom afraid. And I think it's the same with Richie. When he tells a story about how his mom beat him up because he tried to murder him when he was a baby, there's no remorse. They may share these experiences together, and that doesn't mean nothing, but I don't get the impression he feels bad about what he's about to do. If he wants to bring Joey back in the fold, he didn't even make him an offer.
I don't think he can, because the big bosses won't let that happen. You cost me a lot, Joey, a hell of a lot. But as he turns his chair, the look on his face is not joy. I don't think he wants to do it. But at the same point, you're right, he is crazy. He is a badass. He's obviously killed a lot of people. He's not a good man. Neither of them are. Well, the Joey part. And by the way, we probably should have said this already, but Joey, Tom, if we say those names, is the same person. Although there's a distinct difference.
Yeah.
When Viggo Mortensen goes into Joey mode. Incidentally, when I first saw this movie, Ed Harris sounds to me like he's saying Joey Jusack in the early part of the film. Maybe it's just me that always heard that rather than Cusack, because it is spelled exactly like John and Joan.
And I think that the film is making the argument that two distinct personalities can live within one person. That he can be Tom and Joey at the same time. As violent as Joey is as good and kind and gentle as Tom is. He can actually put Joey to bed. He had put Joey to bed. He had eliminated him from his life.
For close to 2 decades.
Yeah.
Because his son is, what, 15 or so? He talked about 3 years he became Tom. He would have had to meet Edie, court her, have a kid. So probably 18 or so years since he left Philly. Maybe even closer to 20. And speaking of personalities who can exist inside of one movie character, we mentioned The Fly already. He's both a great scientist, but also, obviously, somebody who's got this capacity for rage and violence and murder when he becomes the Fly. The twin brothers in Dead Ringers.
Oh, yeah.
And I could go through all of Cronenberg's resume, but I bet that's a recurring theme, where one person has the Darth Vader thing of the real bad guy, but also the good guy underneath. Now, maybe it's laid on a little bit too thick, how perfect Tom's life is. His family is so nice and so wonderful. You see the rare depiction of passionate sex in a married couple in a movie, and also a 69, which you rarely see in any movie. Even something like Basic Instinct, you didn't really see much in the way of, okay, you eat me out while I eat you out. You rarely see that in any movie other than a porno. And these two have been married for, like I said, about 15 or so years, probably. Their marriage is passionate, but it's also kind of ordinary. We'll talk about their other sex scene later on. Let's get back to the beginning, though, because this does have one hell of a first shot and first scene. It's done in one long take until Billy walks into the office of that little motel. And it's misleading because Leland and Billy look like they're going to be major parts of this story. Yes, they're why the story even happens, because they go to Tom's diner, start trouble, Tom has to kill them, and so on. But they seem like they're going to be the key to the movie, and really, they're on screen for, kind of like Richie's bad guy character, about 10 or 15 minutes. Their first take, you don't know what the hell is going on, until you realize that they're about to kill people just because they don't want to pay the bill, I guess.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting things about them. One of the things I like about those two characters, well, as you said, the fact that it's really set up for us to expect them to be major characters, and then they're offed pretty quickly and learn that they're completely incidental. It could have been anybody holding up the diner. It's just that they got him national attention, and this totally other psychopath went after him next. I love that we never learn their story of why they're on the lam. We know that they have to stick to small towns and they're kind of miserable about the fact that they're running away from something. We never learn what it is, whether they're running from the cops or they're running from the mob. And something I find so curious about them is how different they are. Mm-hmm. Different ages, different styles of dress. They don't look like they belong together at all, and you can sense that there's a really interesting story right there in and of itself. But we never learn it, because they die, and then their stories end. But it's just one of the elements of this film that gives it a little extra depth and makes it a little more interesting.
Stephen McHattie is Leland, the older guy. He's a Canadian. Quite a few Canadians are involved in this movie. Sam, the sheriff, is Canadian. Peter McNeil. And, of course, Cronenberg is. And then Billy is Greg Bryk, or Brick, B-R-Y-K. He was in a couple of the Saw sequels. And he also, to me, looks like he could be related to Viggo Mortensen. He looks like a younger version of him. So maybe in some ways the movie is throwing out there that these two guys could have been Richie and Joey.
And, of course, he commits... The first act of violence that we see is just one of the most sickening, crazy, shocking acts of violence. We know that his partner off-screen shot up the motel lobby.
No, not shot
up. That's right, he stabbed them, it's quiet. Mm-hmm. But he's got the gun and he murders the only witness, which is a little girl who is clearly terrified, and he acts like he's trustworthy and then pulls out the gun. Forget the first time I saw this movie, every time I see this movie, which is many times now, it is just a shocking and disturbing act.
But you pointed out when the film is over, during the credits, you're talking about how you're not a fan of some of the performances. That little girl, not that we want to bash on a kid, but then the bully, Kyle Schmid, not Schmidt, but Schmid, so cartoonish.
Oh, yeah.
So like, we just said that in the red letter performances, the lead performances of Cronenberg's film, some of the great work that they've ever done, Goldblum and Irons for sure, and The Fly and Dead Ringers, Viggo in this, and maybe even more so in Eastern Promises. But the supporting performances, when we watched The Dead Zone last year, you weren't a huge fan of Christopher Walken in that movie. I was, but we did agree that some of the other performances are not the greatest. So when Cronenberg either directs really well, or maybe it's casting, who knows, but in some cases it's not so good. It's not really Kyle Schmid's fault that he's such a bully. It's written that way. That's Josh Olson and that's David Cronenberg, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot going into his performance. When I talk about some scenes seeming movie of the weekish, that is the first thing that comes to mind, is everything that takes place in that school, everything that takes place with his son. That actor does like a pretty decent performance as Ashton Jack. Holm,
the actual son, yeah, not the bully.
He's fine, but everybody around him is so bad. And it's so strange because Cronenberg will get these career best performances out of Mortensen and especially William Hurt.
Maria Bello as well.
Maria Bello and Ed Harris. They're all really wonderful, but then you have this movie of the week villain.
Yeah, he hits the easiest pot fly in the history of gym class, but acts all cocky that he's going to win the game. Jack catches it. Isn't really a hero. He just catches an ordinary pot fly that anybody who's ever touched a baseball glove before had a chance of catching, and then it's this whole sort of, it's on!
It's dumb!
It's fucking gym class, dummy, yeah. As Jack even says to him. And you could say, well, that's what bullies do. And but Jack, that's been done in 1,000 movies and TV shows better than it is in this movie.
And Jack is a good-looking kid. He seems fine. He can talk. He can play sports, at least marginally. There's nothing about him that screams outcast to me like he should be somebody who should get picked on either.
It reminds me of the scene in Parenthood where Steve Martin's son catches a pop fly and another bully-type kid gets in the way and actually messes it up, but then somehow Steve Martin's son dives and catches the ball and saves the game. And it's the one high point, one of the best things about that movie, and we might cover that this year because it is the 30-year anniversary, but one of the best things about it is that after that high point for the team, and Steve Martin as the coach is so happy, my son did something great, something bad happens later on, and Mary Steenburgen, who plays Martin's wife, points out, do you think he was going to do something good in T-ball and everything would be fixed?
Mm.
Of course not. But maybe that's an homage, Parenthood, to History of Violence, because they're both playing right field, they both make a fairly ordinary catch. The son in Parenthood's forced to make a tougher catch than they should have been, but also with really idiotic bullies. In that case, at least, with Parenthood. It's a little kid, so you can forgive the not-so-great acting. But you said early on you weren't going to really bash in this movie too much. But we already got into one thing right there, that some of the other performances are not as good. What about their perfect life where they're always drinking hot drinks? There's constant offerings of coffee. Coffee! Sometimes tea. A little running theme in this movie.
Well, it's all very cozy, right? It's all exactly what you imagine a perfect farmhouse American family to be like.
That was it too much for you then?
That wasn't too much for me, the way the high school stuff was too much for me. Yeah, his family is definitely over-the-top perfect, except for the fact that his son gets bullied. Their little girl's also, like, a pretty tragically bad actress. I don't know if you agree with me on that level, but what's her name? Heidi?
I didn't write down her actual name.
Sarah, the little girl. She didn't really do much after this, you said. I guess it's a little bit overkill. It doesn't bother me. I think because their performances are so sincere. Mortensen and Bello just have so much amazing natural chemistry together. You're really not thinking about it. And you have to have faith that when you're watching a movie, the first act, you know it's going to be set up and you read the film language. This is a happy man and a happy family. He likes his job. He likes his town. He likes his life. It would be a shame if somebody were to come and spoil it all for him, which is exactly what happens.
The tagline was something like, Tom Stahl had the perfect life until he became a hero. Tom knows that him being outed as a hero is a bad thing, being in the national news. We don't know then why that's a problem. We learn as it goes along. Do you think that Tom ever really truly forgot he was Joey? His brother asks him at one point, do you dream as Joey? But forget that. You can't control what you dream about. Does he just ever truly forget, I was this guy from Philly? He denies it so much. It's one of the things I've said many times in this podcast. I love when a character has to act. So an actor is acting. This guy has been acting for decades.
And Tom's performance is incredibly convincing as an audience member. The first time you see this film, when he's in the diner saying you got the wrong guy, you're like, well, he clearly has the wrong guy. I believe Tom.
Do you think that he believes that in his own mind? If you could put him a lie detector test right then and there, or get into his mind as if you're God, does he know he's really Joey at that moment?
I think the film never implies he doesn't understand what's going on at all times. Just because he's untroubled with the duality doesn't mean that he doesn't understand what's happening, what he's doing. He's troubled only insofar as he knows that it puts his marriage in danger, his family in danger, and that he could be arrested. He's a criminal. He's committed murders. And then he commits more murders. You think the cops are never going to catch on to who committed that massacre in Philadelphia? There's lots of breadcrumbs leading back to Tom. And it wouldn't take that much for somebody to do a little bit and be like, wait a minute, this guy has no past. He seems to have arrived out of nowhere 20 years ago, although he does say at one point when Edie is asking, why did you pick Tom Stahl? He goes, it was available. Yeah. So it implies that
he killed Tom Stahl.
Or Tom Stahl died and he assumed his identity.
No, he killed Tom Stahl.
I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe. But I choose not to think so. Because I believe he really is more Tom than Joey. He chooses Tom.
I think you're right, but also he switches back into Joey so easily when it's fine. Well, no, he doesn't for a while, but when he's finally forced to, when Fogarty and his guys come to his front lawn, like we say, you can see the shift in him. You can see the way he walks, the way he talks. When he gets a Philly, more so, and it has that Philly accent come back. Yeah, I'm Joey. Or, I'm not doing a good impression, but you get the idea.
See, you're not super guilty of this. You're very much what you see is what you get, but you do accept that we all wear masks and we all will be a certain kind of person for one group. And a different kind of person for another group, the way that you certainly would have behaved differently with your friends in high school than when you got home and you were talking to your parents. You would have used different language, you would have made different kinds of jokes, had a different sense of humor. Lots of people might have even dressed differently and just had a whole different persona. This is the persona he wears with his people in Philly. When he created himself out of nothing and created Tom, don't you think he would have created the person that he truly was rather than the tough guy that he had to be in Philly to get by in the criminal world?
Yeah, so maybe he was acting as Joey all that time, although he probably took a lot of passion in it. He does get back to being a crack shot really quickly, considering he hasn't touched a gun in a long time.
He's very good at killing people.
Right, and that is also a movie thing, because he has to kill those guys when they come into his diner, or else how does the story happen? They would have certainly killed the people in the diner. So, okay, fine, it's a movie thing, you have to let that go by. But he's a natural killer, obviously, and he gets back into it very easily. Now, one thing that's nice about the marriage, I want to talk about that for a little bit here. Edie is in the driver's seat in the early scene. She drives Tom to work. Now, his truck's not working, and he does fix it later when he goes to Philly. Then he's in the driver's seat. But he's never in a literal driver's seat position at any point in this movie until he goes to Philadelphia and then is back to being Joey. The wife drives him to work. He runs to town one day when he's still got that bad foot from being stabbed. Was it stabbed?
Yeah, he stabbed him.
That's a tough guy. He'll run from work all the way home. Again, a movie thing. He has to do it for the sake of the scene. But still, he's got a lot of toughness in him. But he's always the passenger. Now, that's a more modern thing in the society anyway. Women drive cars or trucks with their husbands beside them a lot more often than they did 20 or 30 or 50 years ago.
They got female vocalists, female motorists.
What's that from?
The Simpsons.
Okay, right.
When Lisa goes to military school.
You know what I'm saying, right? There was a time my mom rarely drove when we were all in the car together. She didn't even have a license until she was about 30-something years old.
But you don't get the impression that Tom has a problem being in the passenger seat, and I actually think that it's clear that Edie's the boss of their marriage. She's not bossy, but every marriage has a power dynamic, and there's always one person who's just a little more in charge, and she's definitely the one that's in charge.
Yeah.
He is more afraid of losing her than she is of him. As in love as they are, she is in the driver's seat, metaphorically, and literally.
And then later on, when she finds out about who he really is, first of all, she vomits. Now, that was a run of things we had seen in that weekend. We watched the movie right around New Year's. We'd seen a lot of things in those few days where people were vomiting.
Especially The Favorite. There's a lot of vomiting.
All three of the main characters in The Favorite puke at one time or another in that one movie. So anyway, she pukes when she finds out who he is. And then not long after, they have their stair sex scene. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like that before.
Let's talk about it.
It's said that this is the first time a stuntman was ever asked for pads for somebody to have a sex scene, but then you don't see a lot of sex on stairs. It's a very key moment. A lot of people might have an issue with the way this scene goes, but I think I heard this on the commentary. I definitely looked for it when we watched it a few days ago. Edie, what, slugs him, punches him?
She slaps him.
Okay, right, slaps him. He grabs her by the throat, pushes her up against the wall. Not cool, granted, but at least he does stop, and it's almost like, I'm not this guy. I'm not going to hurt my fucking wife of all people. Edie grabs him as if she's saying, you started this. Finish it. Take me right here and now, you fucking mobster.
She's not one bit afraid of him, which I think is an important detail to the scene. And this scene is touchy, and there's things about it that totally bother me, particularly the scene where he slams against the wall by the throat. Whether the actress, whether the script calls for her to be afraid or not, that's a pretty fucked up thing to put in a movie. You can presume the audience is going to be 50% women, and you just have to ask them to be cool and go with it. I know it's in a lot of movies, but it bothers me every single time. And I really wonder how this film would look if Cronenberg were making it in 2019, you know, this year, instead of in 2005. But like a lot of things, I just have to decide to take it on its face and assume that the intentions were good, even if the execution was a little problematic. But yeah, it helps immensely that Edie throughout the film, entirely, and especially that scene, exhibits a total trust for Tom, never seems even a little bit afraid of him, even when he has his hands around her throat. And I believe every single time I watch that scene that she's in control. She can make a stop anytime she wants, and she knows it. And that's why it's okay to carry on with that scene. There, I've discussed everything that's problematic about it. So let's discuss everything that's just amazing about it. The power dynamic that goes on in that scene and what it says about violence. Did they go over the top when they were illustrating the perfect Midwestern family? Well, what goes on behind closed doors in the perfect Midwestern American family, even the sweet sex that they have, is not exactly what they would traditionally show. Traditionally, they would never show sex. The camera would pan away. They would be respectful. No, we see them 69 each other. And even that she's dressing up in costumes. And what costume does she wear? She dresses like a cheerleader. A very Americana thing. And also something that's both naughty and pure. You love the cheerleader, but you can't have her. She's underage. You love violence, but you can't indulge in it because it's bad. It's wrong. Americans have all this dichotomy that they hold inside them. And especially, I mean, the film's mostly talking about violence and how America both loves violence and they hate violence. They love the vigilante, they hate the criminal. The fact that Tom can kill those people in the diner and everybody lauds him as a hero, but then the murders that take place just days later when he's back in Philly, he would spend the rest of his life in prison for and be considered a monster.
I don't know, it's kind of a Taxi Driver thing. Travis Bickle is rewarded as a hero in that movie because he takes out a bunch of mob people in a pimp house. Somebody call it pimp house? Well, anyway.
Brothel.
That's it, that's what I'm looking for. Same thing here. A bunch of mobsters get killed.
Maybe, but the public would not feel the same about him for those murders.
No, because it's that whole sort of, as it said by his cook, they were going to kill us. There's no doubt about it.
And it's true.
And we know that's true because we saw what happened
in
the motel earlier on. And these guys were going in there for trouble. They're going to get money. And they're not going in there just to take the money and leave. They're going to kill whoever's around. So the two patrons that are still there and the three workers were going to die. Tom did the right thing in trying to save everybody.
And there is the American primal attraction. I mean, it's a human primal attraction to violence. And that's what takes place on the stairs. She hates him. She loves him.
But that's
she's
some passion. Mad. That might be the best
she's
orgasm
horny.
She had in a while. As good
Dude.
As the orgasm probably was in the first scene where she's wearing the cheerleader outfit. That was probably a great orgasm. This one looks like it was even better. And you get the feeling in the future, if this marriage will work, and the movie is very open-ended, seems like at the very end, there's hope at least, that when she's mad at him for whatever reason, if and when they have a fight about anything, it's going to be feral, awesome sex.
And it is feral, awesome sex. I wouldn't say that scene is necessarily a turn-on for me, but it just crackles like fireworks.
It's hotter than anything in the 50 Shades movies.
Oh, well, just about anything is. There's episodes of The Muppets that are a bigger turn-on than 50 Shades.
Oh, Peggy. Waka, waka, waka.
And even at the end of that sex, they haven't made up. He reaches to her because he's still your supplicant in every way.
And she
even
pushes
though,
him away.
Yeah, and she slaps his hand away and he gives up entirely. She still has all the power, even though they've just had this sex that makes it look like he's very much the one in charge, and that's what she wants. She wants him to take charge, to violently have sex with her. You see that there's bruises on her back later. Mm. I think you told me that those bruises were real from the shooting at the scene.
Yeah.
Those were like real injuries that she got from shooting this, because good God, those stairs, I can't even imagine. I don't care how just mad at you I was. I don't...
Just think about any time you've ever had sex with somebody on a hard surface, on a basement floor, even with a rug, but even with a carpet on a basement floor, not the most comfortable feeling in the world. And this is not carpeted. It is a staircase. So no wonder she was actually a little wounded from that, whether she had pads on or not. Let's backtrack a little bit again here. When Fogarty's still alive and he goes after the family. Well, he doesn't really go after the family. The whole thing is he looks like he's going to in the car. The car's outside the diner. Tom runs home. They have the shotgun. Sets it up later on that they have a shotgun as well. That's probably one of the reasons that scene even exists in the movie. I think what's important in that whole scene is, yeah, it's more menace in the film because there's a lot of nothing for a while. Well, not nothing, I shouldn't say that. But there's a lot of non-violence in a movie that's called A History of Violence. So it's suggesting something's about to happen. It's a false alarm. But I think the main reason that scene exists is to show Joey, Tom, thinks Fogarty's going back to his house to do something because that's what Joey would have done. Maybe Joey did do this kind of thing to families. Not for the same reason that Fogarty is, but that's what I would have done back in my days as Joey.
That's a great point. We never learn what he did as Joey. We never learned just how awful he was.
And how well do you really know anyone, especially their past when you didn't know them when they were younger? You didn't meet me until I was in my late 30s or mid-30s, wherever it was.
Oh my God, were you an assassin in Philadelphia?
Philly, yeah. I'm not suggesting that, but you don't know what somebody did in their past. That's one reason why people don't want to know what their sexual past is. This movie's not about sex, but there's plenty of sex in it. A lot of people don't want to know what someone else did with other people. You maybe don't want to know what the past is, and maybe that's why it's so over the top with, you're the best man I've ever known. His son, by the way, seems to have a capacity for this too, because when the bully pushes him too far and they have their hallway fight and Jack clearly wins that fight, it shows that it's inside of him. We're going to talk a lot in 2 weeks when we do our next podcast, because we'll be off next week. But the hereditary violence, if you will, inside of people, maybe not violence, but the ability to do things, let's put it that way, it seems to be passing on from father to son in this film, too.
And it's not just a genetic propensity that he may have, but it's being passed on culturally. He watched his father commit an act of vigilantism. Not just the town, the entire country lauded him. So when he then turns on the bully that's menacing him, he gets in trouble. Then he's like, why am I even in trouble? And of course, he still shoots Fogarty.
Yeah, because his father would have died, except, you got any last words? And then somebody from off-screen kills the guy who she just killed. The hero. Well, anti-hero, I guess, is what Tom is in this. And Fogarty does die, but he wins just by ruining Tom's perfect life. That's not what he wanted in the end, no. But if he could look down from heaven or up from hell or whatever the fuck those concepts are, if he could just know in his afterlife that he messed with this family, even for a little while, there's hope at the end, but it's not necessarily going to work out for this couple or this family. Certainly not the way it was. So Fogarty wins just by doing what he did.
And that scene is different from the violence that takes place earlier in the film. This is a point where the violence starts to get really visceral and repulsive. The acts come with speed, and we're rooting for Tom to win each fight. And then we are faced, especially in this scene, with this gruesome aftermath of these mutilated bodies, victims who are dying painfully. The guy has his nose smashed into his brain, seems to be having some kind of a seizure. It's certainly not the clean, hero saves the day type of violence we're accustomed to. And it kind of makes you think about how spoiled we are with this very neat and tidy violence, that we don't have to watch the villain die in pain.
There's some body horror in this. Cronenberg is known for body horror, especially in The Fly. There's plenty of blood, at least. The most horrifying thing probably in all the killings was when you see Stephen McHattie laying face down with his jaw blown apart and alive for a few more seconds. That's about as close to The Fly as this ever gets. But it definitely makes up for the lack of true horror that Cronenberg has dabbled in so much in so many other films by having there be so many killings. Including in the Brohimov with Hurt and everybody else at the end. How'd you fuck that up? But at the end of it, Joey has to be reborn again, probably in the same way he was before. One of the reasons why he may not get away with this is he throws his gun into the lake behind Richie's place.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be that hard to find that gun if they were to... Maybe they don't think they need to sweep the lake to find weapons, but if they ever thought they could, I don't know, would the fingerprints still be on a gun that's been in the water for a while? Maybe not. But the point is, take the gun with you and throw it in some other body of water, dummy. So he kills his old family by murdering his brother, but he has no choice. What do you think about the ending? Can this family ever be any kind of normal again? And also, will anyone else ever come after Tom? Oh. Richie has bosses. Richie even talks about his bosses. Those guys.
And like I said, it wouldn't be that hard to put together Tom is the killer and that Tom is Joey.
So forget the police, just the mob guys.
Just the mob guys. That's a really good point. I never thought of that. He's not really free. His brother wasn't at the top of that ladder. Even if he was, people might still come after him. I think the movie implies that he's done with it. Probably going to get away with it.
But it may not be done with him.
Don't you think that the ending implies this is over and now the real conflict is whether or not Edie and the family can accept him the way he is?
His daughter and his son do. His daughter puts the table setting in front of him and his son passes him the meatloaf. He looks up at Edie, who doesn't really do anything. Well played by Maria Bello. She's not committing to anything. She's not smiling at him. She's not frowning at him. Obviously, they've had a hard night because he left. He didn't probably even tell his family where he was going. It was the middle of the night. He'd been sleeping on the couch. Richie calls him, first time we ever hear his voice in the whole movie, and then he's gone. So unless he left a note, they don't even know where he went.
So maybe this is my optimistic take. They're going to be fine. Edie has already made up her mind that she is going to find a way to work it out with him. She's been married to this man, or at least known him, as we say, for probably around 2 decades. She knows him. He's had a chance to fuck up for Joey to come out. This is the man that she married. This is the man that she knows. And she trusts that, and she trusts him. And maybe, after all of this is done, they're going to start having these really long and important conversations, and they're going to get to know each other on a level that they never knew each other before, and maybe their marriage will be even better for it? Wildly optimistic here, but I honestly interpret the end of the movie that way, that not only are they going to be fine, but provided the mob doesn't come after them, the cops don't come after them, they will be even better.
I agree. I think that the characters in this family could be just fine. I do worry about Jack. Although he has to defend himself against these bullies. Can't really blame him for popping somebody.
Well, now he's going to go back to school on Monday.
And be a hero.
And he'll be the guy who murdered someone, regardless of it being self-defense or in defending his father.
Oh, not his bully.
Like, I don't think the bullies are going to mess with him anymore.
They probably wouldn't let that get out. They'd probably say that Tom did it.
Maybe. But he's different. Jack is different now. And Jack is okay. The movie never implies that Jack suffers any post-traumatic stress or that he's damaged in some way that's irreparable.
He's got his father in him.
And his father was, in the end, okay with living with the acts that he committed.
I like, by the way, when he says, after the fight in the hallway, not the shooting, we don't solve our problems with violence. No, we solve them by shooting people. So after saying we don't use violence, seconds later he slaps his own son in the face.
I know.
Regardless of the fact that he's upset at his son, you just said you don't use violence. He says one thing to you and you hit him.
Yep.
Which is obviously deliberate. It's very smart on the part of Cronenberg and the writer Josh Olson. Now, Viggo is coming off the Lord of the Rings movies, and of course he did Easter Promises with Cronenberg soon after this one. A good string of films there, good actor. He really didn't come into his own until his mid to late 30s when he did the Lord of the Rings films. We talked about the violence in this movie, obviously very R-rated. And I've said on this podcast before a few times that I love the Lord of the Rings movies, but there's brutal violence in those movies all the way through, and they're all PG-13. We don't see the consequences of what happens with people using swords and arrows and other vicious weapons against each other.
People just fall down and then it's over, yeah.
And History of Violence is the opposite, where you see the brutal effects of using guns and knives and whatever else
to hurt and kill people. The real consequences of violence. Yeah.
So I like that touch, and maybe it wasn't deliberate casting to go against him heroically, always doing the right thing, despite murdering so many characters, creatures, sometimes people, but usually other creatures in the Lord of the Rings. And in this, he does kill so many people, but we feel all of them, even though we want him to kill pretty much everybody he does kill. Yep. He has to.
He needs to commit violence so that he can have peace. The whole film is a study of the conflict of violence versus peace, and can we ever have peace without violence to protect us?
I like the etymology of his name, too. Joey Tom is two names. Joe Pesci's vicious mobster character in Goodfellas is named Tommy.
Do you think that's intentional?
No. But I just got thinking about how it could be Josh Olson's thing, who adapted the graphic novel by John Wagner and Vince Locke from 1997. Maybe they were fans.
I read the novel.
Of Goodfellas. Okay, so was he Tom Stahl?
And Joey Cusack? I can't remember his name. There were a lot of details about the setup that were pretty similar. And then the graphic novel is far, far more violent, but far less effective in a way. There's an additional character in the novel who's Joey's buddy, and they actually show in the novel what happens in the graphic novel. They show Fogarty getting his eye cut out with barbed wire. There's two of them, and then he discovers that for the last 20 years, while he's been living his life in Indiana, his buddy that he left behind has been getting tortured for 20 years.
Jesus.
To the point where he finds him and he's had, I think, both his legs and one of his arms cut off. It's unbelievably, ridiculously over-the-top violent to the point where you're rolling your eyes. This is one of the rare cases where I can say with confidence the movie is absolutely better than the book.
Oh, okay.
I'm not saying I wouldn't recommend the graphic novel, but it doesn't do nearly as elegant of a job with the themes as the film does.
Cronenberg's not a fan of comics, and I read that he didn't even know this was a graphic novel until he was already deep into pre-production. So he stuck with it, but maybe he wouldn't have gone in the first place if he'd known what he was doing. Viggo's getting raves right now for Green Book, which I think will still be in theaters by the time this podcast comes out. He and Mahershala Ali have been getting a lot of raves. I haven't seen the movie. Maybe I will eventually.
It's getting raves from white critics, and there's actually some pushback from black critics, some of whom I follow on Twitter, who are really rolling their eyes at all of the good reviews.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tom/Joey could have been played by Thomas Jane or Harrison Ford. Everyone wants Harrison Ford, especially back in the mid-2000s. Maybe not so much now, but up till that point, they would have wanted him. But Thomas Jane's an interesting one to go with because he'd been in some big-time movies and some good ones. He's pretty good in The Mist a couple years after this. I could see him playing that role, although Viggo was, I think, in the end.
I think of those three. Great casting. Yeah, those three actors, Viggo is the only one that could have given it this much depth and subtlety and authenticity.
I think he's also Stahl because he's stalling the inevitable. He can't really run from the mobsters.
Mm-hmm.
No, he took that name.
Yeah.
But why Wagner Locke picked Stahl was, I think, that. Maria Bello has always been underrated. She's very good in this film. She was nominated for the Golden Globe, I think it was, but not the Oscar. She was on ER before this. She was really good in The Cooler a couple years before this with William H. Macy and Alec Baldwin. But maybe it's the old aging actress thing. She hasn't been in anything all that good in a while, certainly not in any kind of main role. But she's one of those people that never really got her due and probably never will now, unless she goes into some kind of Meryl Streep type thing where she gets roles. Well, then again, Meryl Streep always got great roles, didn't she?
Yeah, so. More like a Helen Mirren thing where she comes out of nowhere.
Mirren was around when she was young and beautiful, too.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
You're right, she only hit whatever stardom she has, and she's not really... Well, she's an A-lister. Sure, she's an A-lister. She's just not as famous as, say, Meryl Streep is, but she's certainly an A-lister. And you're right, she didn't really hit stardom until she got to be quite a bit older. But Bella looks great in this movie, and she's always been a very talented actress. I don't think she ever got her due. We know Ed Harris. We covered him on The Truman Show last year. He's been in so many great films, as has William Hurt. We talked already about some of those. Broadcast News, we covered that a couple years ago, where he's got a lead performance. They've both been around forever. They're always good, or almost always good. And we talked about the other actors, including Ashton Holmes, who hasn't made very many movies. His most recent, just this past year, was Acts of Violence. So History of Violence was one of his first movies, and his most recent was Acts of Violence. A-C-T-S, not Acts, as in... Their director, David Cronenberg, we did The Dead Zone last year, which you didn't have the best feelings about, but I think it's a good movie, despite some of its flaws. We talked about Dead Ringer's a great film. His long resume, he's been around a long... Hasn't made a movie in quite a while, though. I think he basically is retired. He's one of those guys that never says it, but you look at his resume, and he hasn't made a movie in a very long time.
Maps of the Stars.
Okay, well, that's quite a few years ago, isn't it?
Well, it's like 4 years ago. It was terrible. Shortly before that was Cosmopolis.
But he's the kind of guy that made a movie once every couple of years and hasn't for this long.
Sure.
I don't think he's ever really taken a real break, so maybe this is just the end for him. And it's too bad because he doesn't end on the best note. But this is probably his best film. If it's not, then it's The Fly.
He's one of those directors that has made as many misses as hits. It's interesting when he hits his mark. It's beautiful. He really nails it.
And he's a great technical director because we've seen some of that stuff in Scanners and Dead Ringers for a movie that's, I don't know, three or four actors in it. Well, there's more than that, but really one guy playing two roles for most of it. And technically it works. You don't really see the strings in Dead Ringers with all the visual effects they have to do, the traveling mats and whatnot, to have them both on screen. Or Jeremy Irons is playing one guy twice. You could do that so easily now, or easier now, but it's a brilliant technical film.
And he does something that may not always work in all of his films, but I always 1,000% respect. That man surprises me. He shows me things I've never seen before, makes me think of things I've never thought of before. He is a very original, creative mind.
And this movie was not one I loved the first time I saw it back in 2005. I liked it. Then it was really cheap at a video store, one of those previously viewed kind of things. They had it on the shelf for all the time, and they said, here, you buy this thing for something like $5. So I thought, I'll give that another try. You couldn't stream back then. If you wanted to see something, it was going to be probably $3 to rent it as a really old movie anyway. So here's $5. I'll own it. Watch it again. Thought, I was wrong. I liked it the first time, but really liked it later on and ended up being one of the better films of that year. Even though if we talked about my top 10 list from that year, I don't even know what it was. This was not on it, but if I were to redo it, it probably would be.
Topped a lot of people's top 10 lists for that year. And it's definitely in the conversation when people talk about the best films of the 21st century so far. This one makes the list. The top 25 even.
Two of the producers were Chris Bender and J.C. Spink. Bender worked on American Pie, that whole series, and Spink on the Ring films and the Hangover movies as well. Spink died of an accidental drug overdose just a couple of years ago in April 2017. Mm. I didn't know that. I know these names vaguely, but unfortunately he's already dead. He was only about my age when he did die. The movie's 25-1. We watched The Blu-ray, which looked pretty good. The cinematographer, Peter Sushitsky, shot Empire Strikes Back many years ago. Wow. And many Cronenbergs. These three names worked with Cronenberg a ton throughout their careers. The editor, Ronald Sanders, did Cronenberg after Cronenberg after Cronenberg. And the composer, the most famous name of these three, Howard Shore, who worked with a lot of people, especially Cronenberg, but also Scorsese, and The Lord of the Rings, not long before this. So we've seen a lot of Viggo Mortensen over the years. And the music at times is Lord of the Rings-esque. We let the end credits play as we talked about the movie, and some of that music sounded like the gentle Hobbit stuff. So maybe, kind of like John Williams, Shore was repeating something he had just recently done a little bit.
It's a very traditional score. Another thing that, to me, makes a great movie feel just a little bit pedestrian, but my notorious hatred of score.
What about the cutting and the cinematography?
Cinematography didn't really blow me away. Adequate, nothing that stood out to me, really. But that editing... You gotta love a 94-minute running time. I love an editor that can just cut to the chase and get rid of all the chaff. There is nothing in that film that doesn't need to be there.
I bet somebody could argue that if you take out the opening sequence with Leland and Billy and just have them show up in the town and be menacing, that's enough. Maybe they're right, but I like the fact that it's a misleading. I like the fact you see that there's something going on there. I was reading that it's supposed to be that's an uncle and nephew relationship as well. And I think one of them just got out of jail, didn't they? Isn't that implied? Maybe Billy?
Yeah, that's right. He just got out of the joint. As far as the editing goes, too, well, the movie does such a great job of building tension from that first scene when she goes by really slowly and then the slow build-up, and then when the action happens, it's so intense. It's a really great job of building it up and letting us experience the catharsis with them.
Which is one of the criticisms on movies that overcut just in a scene, because you make all the editing mean nothing if it's always fast-paced.
That's a lot of the Marvel movies, in my opinion.
Yeah, sure.
Then you cut everything at the same pace, then the audience never really has highs and lows.
Most of what Michael Bay does is overcut, beyond belief. So the awards and AFI list is pretty short. It was nominated for Supporting Actor, Hurt, who lost out to Clooney. and Olsen's adapted screenplay. Olsen, by the way, has only got a few credits. He worked in the art department on Masters of the Universe back in the 80s.
Wow.
So he hasn't written a lot of screenplays in his life. And History of Violence was nominated for the top 100 genres in the gangster category, but did not make that.
Do you think it's a gangster film? I think it's a Western.
It's got elements of Westerns?
Yeah. Yeah, it takes place in a rural town. Tom is an entrepreneur. He left his city life and came looking for a fresh start in the country. Has a lot of standard Western motifs. Strangers come to a small, happy town and start making trouble. Problems are solved with a brave man thinking fast, using violence. They live in a farmhouse, and there's a couple of gunfight standoffs.
The sheriff doesn't take kindly to people who don't take kindly. Fogarty, the way he just dismisses him when the cop pulls him over like that.
And the townspeople have to solve their own problems. You know, they can't rely on the law, they can't rely on the government. He can't ever turn to the cops and say, I have this problem, can you help me? He has to take care of himself like a good old Western hero.
Like, there's something going on, by the way, with Sam and Edie. A little small story there.
When she made that tea for him, you could see.
I think Sam was in love with her long ago. He likes this family. He's probably not jealous of Tom in the sense of, I wish he was out of the picture. It's more like, if Tom wasn't around, I'd like to be with her.
I bet just about everyone in that town that could have been remotely close to her age would have been in love with her. I mean, look at her. In a small Indiana town, a woman like Maria Bello.
Doesn't he kiss her on the lips? So they're very,
yeah, that's right, he does.
They're very friendly and they have a history. But still, I just get the feeling that that's a little story in itself that's being told. All right, then, last thoughts on your second pick in the month of Bev, the fourth year of us doing this, A History of Violence.
I think this film is a modern classic. I'm happy that it's always in conversations about best films of the century so far. I hope it gets people to see it. Maybe haven't seen it because it's aging like a fine wine.
I agree with that. It's one of the movies, as I said, I didn't love the first time, like it a lot more now. I wouldn't put it on the best of the entire 19 years of this century. I wouldn't say it's that good. Well, it depends what we're talking about. A top 100, maybe. It is one of Cronenberg's best films, one of Vigo's best films. I like The Eastern Promises a lot, too. Talk about a violent fight in that one. The naked bathhouse brawl he has with people, the violence in that as well. Whew.
He uses nudity well, because he doesn't really use nudity to be sexy, but he uses it to be vulnerable. Or in the case of Maria Bello in this film, there's this power in her nudity when you actually see her naked.
Very briefly, full frontal.
Yeah, nudity is used to scare you in Hereditary, because it's just so subversive and shocking and out of place. And it's kind of the same that, whoa, what's going through her head? There's some scary shit happening with that woman.
You don't see Bello naked in the two sex scenes, I don't believe, but you do when she's mad at him, when she's wearing a robe, but it's open after the sex scenes.
Exactly. There's just something subversive about that, but it makes it so effective, so smart.
People don't use nudity in movies as well as they probably should. That's a great example of where they did, and in 2 weeks from now, Hereditary.
And in Eastern Promises, Vigo goes full frontal, and really, really interesting use of nudity in a scene that could have come across as silly. It comes across as quite subversive and unique.
It's so memorable, partly because he is naked when he has to kill those guys. So we recommend Eastern Promises, too. All right, we're off next week because we'll be devouring sun and mixed rum drinks down in Cuba.
Some Cuba Libre.
When we return in 2 weeks, we'll jump into some terrifying territory as we review a movie we just mentioned, a horror film that came out just this past June, Hereditary.
We were going to cover something else, and then we talked ourselves into doing Hereditary instead, partly because we're just both so crazy about the film, we can't wait to really dig into it.
I'll talk about this in 2 weeks when we do that podcast. But definitely before you get to our podcast, if you're interested in Hereditary, look for Screen Junkies Universe, but just under Screen Junkies on YouTube. Dan Merle Roth Cornett do a spoiler review of it. It's about 45 minutes long. Fascinating. One of the reasons why I thought, let's do Hereditary instead of Happiness, which is one of your original choices for this month. Happiness, the movie from 1998, Todd Solondz's film.
I think a lot more people are probably going to be curious about our thoughts on Hereditary.
Well, that's also true.
I love Happiness, but I don't think that it's going to get quite as many clicks.
But going back and seeing Dan and Roth's review, which was months ago, but I just saw it about 2 weeks ago. This may be your month, but I was pushing you a little bit to do Hereditary.
Oh, whatever. I love this movie.
An easy push.
Easy sell. Yeah.
Okay, so the coming attractions trivia. Toni Collette has played a mother in several horror pictures. Other movies too, but especially these horror movies. The Sixth Sense, we know that. Fright Night, Krampus, and Hereditary. Which of those has the best Rotten Tomatoes reviews? Which was the most financially successful? And which is your favorite?
Oh.
Will it be the same thing?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Hereditary. But if you just can't wait until then and you just need some more Ryan and Bev in your life, you can check out our website, top100project.com. And you can subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster. We've covered hundreds of movies now, far more than the 123 movies we originally covered. All the movies that made AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is online. It's available for free. Perhaps in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
See you in 2 weeks, Brohims.
And cut.